is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. John Cranley summed up his State of the City address Wednesday night with,
"What your city is trying to do. If you are facing a shooter, we will send our cavalry. If you need a second chance, we will send our cavalry. If you need job assistance, we will send our cavalry. We don't always get there in time, like we did for Richard, Lewis, and Prudhoe, but we do try. And when we fail, as we did in the case of Kyle Plush, we commit to do better."
To discuss the mayor's vision and other developments at City Hall, we are joined today by WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman, Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome back, everybody.
Thanks for having us there.
Jay, how would you characterize the mayor's State of the City address this year? You've heard multiples of these.
It was more of a look back, and he like a year in review. And he didn't try to hide, you know, some of the major shortcomings that the city's faced in the last year with the tragedy on Fountain Square, you know, the issues with the Emergency Communications Center and the tragedy with Kyle Plush. And he worked in some positives. He mentioned that the number of contracts going to minority-owned and women-owned firms have increased, and the economic development projects underway in various communities. One thing that I think was a little strange, normally you can do a year in review, but you also do like a major announcement of a new program for the upcoming year. And I don't think that was there this year.
Nothing major.
Although, and in my mind, my cynical mind, I thought, you know, even the routine business now is becoming a big deal. So let's – the routine business takes enough time, so we'll just focus on that.
Sherry, how do you think the mayor dealt with the Kyle Plush tragedy? I mean, that's certainly a major thing in this past year and will drive policy forward.
You know, honestly, we've had a very tough year in the city. You know, there have been some big fights and there have been some very sad days. You know, I can't remember like past years when I've cried at work over covering City Hall. And it's that kind of year. And, you know, those people were in the room, people who handled those things, people who were victims of them. And I thought he handled it really well. We had moments of silence. And, you know, he also brought up a shooting that had not been reported. It involved drugs, and the police department really, you know, they're still working on it and they hadn't like put a lot of things out. And it was like, it was an emotional moment. We had like two innocent bystanders were shot in the incident he was talking about. And one of the women was sitting in the front row and she was crying. And she just said, "Thank you." Like in a speech where no one's really talking, there's some applause, you know, but it's not a time where things like that typically happen. It was a very emotional moment. She did say thank you to him.
Yeah, that was. I mean, there were a lot of people who he called up to thank. But there are also those people, including Kyle Plush's parents, who were in the audience, and he asked them to stand, but they didn't come up. And I think those were all sort of really human moments. Chris, what was missing from the speech?
Well, actually, I wanted to say something that – I mean, the one thing that I focused on that was there in terms of – I like Jay, I always look for the year ahead. I guess I'm not as much interested in recounting the events of the year because I saw all of them and I was there. So, you know, I try to always spin ahead and look at what he's talking about going forward. There was one thing that we ended up writing about that affects business. It's called 2030 districts, mm-hmm. and Kroger and 8451 are apparently going to participate in this. This is kind of an environmental effort to reduce these companies and their employees' impact on the environment through transportation, through the use of water in their buildings, through the use of electricity and other utilities.
Trying to bring it down 50%.
Yeah. Right, 50%. I mean, it's a major, major drop. And these are there's a bunch of cities around the country. I think we're the 22nd one in the country to be a part of this. So I think we'll be looking at the Courier, Business Courier, at – you know, how's Kroger going to accomplish this? The mayor noted that Kroger has a ton of real estate, not only their downtown headquarters, which is huge, but also all of their stores throughout the region. And so you know, we'll be interested, for example, are they going to do it in Kentucky too? And, you know, any store they have, you know, elsewhere and not, you know, not just inside the city of Cincinnati. So, you know, that was one thing that I thought was there that was interesting and kind of a new program going forward. I think I would have agreed with Jay, though, that I would like to hear more about, you know, we have 3 years left of this mayoralty, actually, which is kind of, as Sherry said, it's been a long year, and it seems like it's been 2 years worth of stuff happening instead of just one. So got a long way to go with this mayor, and I think people would, and I think this was kind of a criticism during the 17 election, too, like, what is the plan for going forward? What kind of city do you want Cincinnati to be at the end of your term?
It's also interesting, too, that I think that started mainly with Mayor Mallory, but how it's become more State of the Union-like. You know, it used to be, I think, years ago, the speech was given at the Rotary Club, at one of their regular month or weekly meetings. But then it moved to, it's an outside venue, and you're giving awards for Cincinnati of the Year, Humanitarian of the Year, Volunteer of the Year, and, you know, recognizing different people. And it's just like the State of the Union where, you know, stand up applause. And it didn't – used to be it was just a more of an address, and now it's turned into sort of a more production with lots of thank yous and lots of videos.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things – let me just mention two things that I didn't hear.
Right.
And Sherry, maybe you want to react to this. One is we're still trying to figure out the final budget.
And that well, actually, in fairness, we're done with that, we think. We think.
We think. Yeah. Well, it wasn't mentioned. And secondly, MSD, which is really looming out there and is in the courts. And neither of those really got mentioned. He thanked the head of MSD, but – that's not the same
thing. I
mean,
to mention MSD, though, would be like there's nothing good to say about it right now. There's lawsuits and counter lawsuits and no plan. And in fact, there was actually a protest outside of the State of the City. I'm walking
in. It was about MSD, wasn't it?
It was about MSD, and it was about rates. Like, this is something it doesn't – we haven't reported, like, tons on it every once in a while. I mean, they're so high, and it's very difficult for homeowners with low income and – they came to the State of the City and had a protest outside of it. That was the first time I'd seen a protest.
There was one development on MSD in the last, I would say, 10 days. The city filed notice of appeal. The judge told the city that it cannot withdraw from MSD. Mm-hmm. And the city's actually appealing that. And I don't know necessarily it's because they want to withdraw, but or use it as leverage really with the county. They definitely want some things out of the county before they kind of continue their relationship. But the court bickering is continuing unabated.
Yeah, but this is really a substantive issue, not only because of rates, but also because of what's going to happen with retirement and the retirement fund of the city. A lot of things hinge on this, both structurally and for individual people. So I agree with you. I think this is just one of those things that's out there that needs addressing.
No, I always say the two things, if I don't, like, I mostly get reaction to stories on Twitter or email or whatever. But the two things that prompt reaction unprompted is sewer rates and litter.
And litter.
Mm-hmm. But I think this is one of those, I mean – the county and the city are going to bicker, and I think I've kind of said from the beginning it's going to be – they're not going to like it, but the same judge that did the collaborative agreement for the retirement system is the same federal judge that's in charge of the MSD case now, and he can't let one fall apart without one – if one falls apart, it's going to affect the other one, and he's going to give them an order, and probably neither side is going to like the outcome, but that's probably how it's going to be settled is –
I'll be interested to see how he threads that, you know, because, you know, I'm not telling the judge anything he doesn't know. He's mandated to follow the law. And if the law in the MSD case contradicts the law that he might have established or the settlement, I should say, that he presided over in the pension case, I'm not sure that he can get around that.
Sherry, one other thing, probably the most dramatic contrast the mayor drew in the State of the City the other evening was between the shooting on Fountain Square and a shooting in the West End, which many people had not heard about. And this became a showstopper in some ways because he was using it to say the city responds to everybody who's in trouble. We send the cavalry. That was his image. Yeah. We send the cavalry, no matter who they are, no matter what neighborhood it is.
And, you know, I certainly agree with that. Like, I mean, we see it time and time again. You know, there was a police officer shooting this year. And, like, I mean, no one suggests otherwise. I was surprised, like, to see just in the middle of the speech, like, all these details of a gang war.
Right.
It was odd that we'd not heard about. And the police department was very surprised that it was mentioned, because I was like, now what about this? We hadn't heard about it. And it's like, which is very typical in big drug things. The police department's not dragging out like giant investigations like, here's how we're doing everything and here's what's going on. That's not how drug and gang operations work in the city. In fact, a lot of these cases end up being filed under seal. And so that was just a lot of surprise there. And some of this case is filed under seal because we're trying to look up details of it and like find out about it. And it's like, I don't know.
I liked the sentiment of that remark, because I think our society as a whole, and Kyle Plush reminds me of this in a way, you know, I think we definitely, there's a focus in our society on bad things that happen to white people and maybe not so much sometimes that happens to African Americans. So I enjoyed I thought the sentiment was good. I don't know why he kind of took a little bit of a shot at the media, and I'm not sure what that was about, but you know, that is what it is. You know, the city can communicate that with us if they wanted to. And I think it's not really our cup of tea at the Business Courier, but I'm sure that other media organizations would be covering that if they'd let them know.
Well, you know, compared to certain other shots at the media, that was
right.
that was relatively mild. I think we'll survive that.
Nobody's going to send a bomb to us because of the mayor's remarks, that's for sure.
Okay. In the heated and ugly argument over what to do when Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley wanted to get rid of Cincinnati city manager Harry Black, Cranley's council opponents were working out a strategy via text. Now a judge says those conversations have to be revealed. Who's going to be damaged? How badly? To delve into this, we are joined by Cincinnati Enquirer, City Hall reporter from WVXU, Jay Hanselman, the Cincinnati Business Courier reporter, Chris Wetterick, and Cincinnati Enquirer reporter, Sherry Coolidge. Sherry, you've written about this. You and Chris have written about this extensively. What do we know so far? One part of the text have been released. Others are coming. The rest of them are coming next week.
The public part of the text have been released. And it was a long time coming. We have been talking about group text messages between council for months since Harry Black was, you know, let go from the city.
So what did we learn?
So last Friday, after this show, we actually got the group texts. Mm-hmm. Council released them. They responded to public records requests, and they released that there were several times when five members of council spoke with each other, and they released them. And they, you know, they said, these are a majority of council talking, and here they are. And you would think that would be the end of things. But there is a lawsuit over these.
Two.
And the Inquirer, two.
Three then. Or four. There's a lot.
And then, so
we
these texts come out.
Lawyer.
This is late Friday. Monday morning, there's a hearing before Judge Ruhlman in Hamilton County Common Pleas Court over at getting them, right? But here they are. They're already out. But that doesn't mean the litigation is stopping. And it was a very dramatic hearing, because typically when you go over for court hearings, you have a bunch of attorneys talk, and they, you know, they make their arguments, and the judge sits there and listens, and you have the different sides. But, I mean, we just had so many attorneys, they're representing council members, they're representing the city, and everybody's making their case. And Judge Ruhlman was not just sitting there and listening. I mean, he was very pointed. You know, they were talking about, we're talking about other texts. Like, were these all the texts, or are there more, right? And people on behalf of council members were arguing, these are all of them, and there's nothing more to see here. And Brian Shrive is arguing that he needs to see them as part of discovery.
He's the lawyer for Coast, is that right?
For Mark Miller.
Yes, yeah. I mean, this does involve Coast. I would not say otherwise, but in this case, technically, it's Mark Miller on behalf of citizens.
Right.
And so he's arguing to – he needs to see everything. And the judge is just asking questions the whole time. And he's like, I'll be the judge of that. We need to see these. And for a hearing I thought would be decided later, I'm like, I better get out my computer and start, you know, we're going to have a story here. And the judge ruled from the bench that text messages between two council members should be part of Brian Shrive's case.
That he needs these text messages to gather evidence. That's what the judge ruled. Judge Ruhlman ruled, and he didn't rule that they're a public record, I think, which is important to mention. However, he did not place, as the council members requested, a protective order on the text messages. So when Brian Shrive receives these from the city and the council members, he will have a choice to make. Does he release these to any reporter? Does he keep them to himself? Does he release some and not others? And it's important to talk about, these are text messages between one, two, three, or four people. We already have the text messages between the five council members, and we should name them: P.G. Sittenfeld, Chris Seelbach, Wendell Young, Tamaya Dennard, and Greg Landsman.
The so-called gang of five.
The so-called gang of five, the five Democrats. Let's be honest. We've had gangs of five at City Hall for about 50 years now. It's not anything new.
I try not to use that term because so often it's being said now in a derogatory tone lately. But yet in the text themselves, they refer to themselves as that. And right. So it's very difficult. It's like, should I use that term or not use that term?
It's an image back there from when, from the late 70s, early 80s.
Right.
That's back there. Yeah.
And so, you know, the interesting question will be what Shrive does with these texts and its potential impact on another case. This case that we're talking about right now is a case about whether they violated the Open Meetings Act. I think it's pretty clear that they did because they had this five-way text message discussion. And
made decisions.
But there's another lawsuit that Shrive and Miller have brought that argues that the text messages are public records, that they're like a document that you would have at City Hall and that the public would be able to see them. And he makes the argument that any text between two or three or four or five or 10, you know, that is a public record. However, the city has said if these text messages become public prior to the adjudication of that case, the case is moot and we don't actually have any case law. And the end result will be these guys had their text messages released, but we don't actually have any ruling on whether they're really public record or not. And so that's I think, the issue there and where Judge Ruhlman made what I would say is a very interesting decision, and he had some very charged language with it as he made it.
And as Chris, as I talked about on the air Monday about this, the council members may have some decisions too, because if Shrive is selective in the text that he releases, he doesn't release all of them, then the council members are going to have to decide, well, if he's going to be selective with what he releases, then do we counter him and we release everything?
Everything.
Because there's all kinds of rumors about this at City Hall. And, beyond that, I don't think I want to go there. But
based on that, though, based on what we've already seen, is there anything in there that's just totally surprising?
I wasn't surprised by any of it. I mean, it was interesting. You know, they talked about their decision in the Harry Black thing. They talked about other, you know, issues, including the mayor's appointment of a Coastal Line person to the Sorta board and some other things. I mean, it was interesting, but and that's the value in this, is understanding how the decisions are made and why, and that's at the core of this issue.
Takeaway was it wasn't so much. So all of these group texts get released late Friday. The biggest takeaway wasn't like, oh, these salacious gossip that we've heard are in them. It's more like, wow, these conversations between a majority have been going back to January. At one point, Greg Landsman said, can we be doing this? And there was like even a question about it. They keep doing it. And to me, and like one of the conversations happened during a council meeting. While we were probably all sitting there and reporting, they're talking amongst themselves privately. Right. And so that was kind of the takeaway. It's like, wow, this really has been going on.
I think we should also look at this a little bit more soberly. Like, it isn't like these are the only five council members that text each other. And we have a standing public records request that has been denied for text between the mayor and the other four council members that has been denied by the city.
I forget, Chris. Why didn't they give those to you?
They claim that it's not public record, which is...
No, it's something else, right?
I don't know. What are you thinking of?
Didn't somebody's phone... Something happened?
Oh, well, let's... The mayor's hot tub accident with his phone actually occurred in February. So he's got texts around the time of the Harry Black ordeal now. They corrected the date on that. Initially, they thought it was March, but it's actually February or April or something.
But if they release the when if you see the text between the 2 and the 3 and the 4, that's where you're probably going to get some salacious details.
Very much.
And there could be embarrassment and collateral damage to even folks who aren't on council.
Sherry, one of the things, I think it was in the article you wrote, you single out the text from P.G. Sittenfeld where he talks about who should tell and when the city manager, Harry Black, he needs some sort of counseling. And, you know, coming from sort of a business leadership background training, if he had used the term he needs a job coach or a mentor, I'm not sure if that would have read the same way, but I wonder if that's what he really meant.
It's not what he really meant.
You don't think so?
There were a lot of issues with the city manager making late-night telephone calls. There was, like, at one point, 5 cases of retaliation against him by city employees. It was related.
You went beyond
that. It was related to his behavior, and it is, okay. You know. So I think we should say here, too, is, like, you know, we had to say it in text. We couldn't say it in a public meeting because we didn't want to embarrass him. And here we are. You know, council is seeking to have executive sessions where they could discuss very issues like this. And this is like literally the example they're using to have those. And yet at the same time.
Isn't that exactly the
mayor's opposed
the point.
To executive sessions. He calls it a secret meeting.
Exactly the point about issue 12.
Right.
Which is going to be on the ballot and which is common in many governments across the state. But, and it's reverted back to state law.
But let's carry this out. So let's go to the fact that we now decide text messages among public officials are a public record.
Right.
We establish that. I can guarantee you what's going to happen. All the aides are going to be texting and sharing. So the, you know, one council aide will text another council aide, and then they're going to share that with their boss, and then that is not going to be a public record.
Oh, I would say it is. Absolutely. If the judge rules that the council members' texts are public record, I would think the aides would be as well.
Employees.
Yeah. But they're public employees just as much as the council members are.
You know, honestly, this isn't just us. I went to IRE 2 years ago, and I was on a investigative reporters. It's like, you know, a conference to get tips and become better. And, like, I was in a session with basically city hall reporters from all over the country. And, you know, I asked, we were talking – this topic came up and I asked the room, you know, what's everyone doing about this? And it ended up being the entire conversation because every single reporter was like, they're doing business on their phones. We don't know if they're public. And it's a very difficult topic. It's like technology and how it's affecting city hall business. And it's not just here.
Okay. I want to move on to one more topic before we run out of time. And that is, and I think all three of you have written about this, is the whole question around FC Cincinnati and the ballet property. So, Chris, what's at stake here, and who said what to whom?
Well, you know, the short
tiptoe around this carefully.
Yeah, the short version of this is the ballet has a lease with some land that FC recently purchased. It says that it wants to keep that lease and stay there, even as it considers some expansion at another site. And their parking lot is in FC Cincinnati's stadium footprint. And that's an issue that FC has not resolved with them, and they want it resolved. And I'll let Sherry pick up from there.
Oh, thanks, Chris.
And then I'm going to make a comment about it. But
you
go
know,
ahead.
So I think we have time. 2 weeks ago now, the stadium renderings came out.
Right.
And, you know, all along the ballet, it's their understanding they have the lease. They're basically on the edge of what the stadium's going to be. The rendering, and they say it's been very difficult to deal with FC. They don't have a lot of answers. Publicly released stadium renderings, and there is no parking lot. And, you know, I think they just – and the fence
no parking lot for the ballet, which correct. Is right across the little alley.
And it's getting to be crunch time. The fence is going up. Construction is going to be starting. And here we are. I think they became very frustrated. They invited separately Chris and myself to go over to, you know, hear – their frustrations.
We had heard, you know, once they brief council aides, then we kind of know stuff. But, you know, I think we both heard in the week leading up there that there was an issue there. So
do you think, I mean, the question was, did somebody say to somebody at FC, to Jeff Birding, that we'll need $1 million to settle this?
Yes.
I am highly skeptical of the – not necessarily that no one floated $1 million or whatever, but that this was a shakedown attempt. We have a tendency in this city lately when large institutions and billionaires and elected officials want to, you know, have big developments in historically impoverished areas – to view these business negotiations as an opportunity for leverage and to accuse people of extortion and other dastardly words when it's actually a business negotiation and you have to engage in that. So
I think this
is not, if I could say one more thing, this is not building a stadium out in the cornfield of Butler County, and people have leases and they have rights that have to be, you know, addressed.
Okay. Really quickly, Sherry.
So, I mean, I don't think anyone really saw where this was going, but, you know, Jeff Birding from FC, he said his response to the ballet's concerns was that they're trying to shake me down for $1 million. He himself said the ballet asked for $1 million. That's where that came from to start. There are other people saying it, but...
The ballet had a hard denial of that, by the way.
The ballet's position is if that happened, it's unauthorized. But yeah,
nobody
the
authorized
position.
It. The ballet, right? So. All right. Well, this is going to evolve, and probably, as Sherry said, the construction fences are going to go up. So this is going to evolve quickly. So I have to
say, I'd say so. Yeah,
Jay, Sherry, Chris. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The way that police use force is a national issue. A lot of attention has been focused on the issue in the city of Cincinnati in recent years, but what about in surrounding communities? That's the focus of a recent iTeam report, actually several reports, on WCPO. We are joined now by the executive producer and chief investigative reporter of WCPO's iTeam, Craig Cheatham, and multimedia producer Brian Nisi. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
And Craig, let's start out. What did you try to do in this investigation? What was the scope? What were you trying to focus on here?
We wanted to find out how local police departments and sheriff's offices approach the use of force. When they determine that force is appropriate, the type of force that's used, and their response to officers that use force.
As I understand from the two reports that I've seen, is that there were 32 departments that you had data from.
Correct.
Were they all suburban departments? Were they all outside the city of Cincinnati, or were you using city of Cincinnati?
We're also using the city of Cincinnati and I think most of the larger sheriff's departments in the metro area.
Okay. So what constitutes use of force? What on a report makes it force?
Well, it's what you would – I think it's what most people would expect. Anytime an officer forces someone physically to do something that that person doesn't want to do, generally that's considered force by most law enforcement agencies. What we've noticed is that police departments define that differently. Some police departments have officers who have wrestled people to the ground, who have actually – and one department is actually – used a taser and had a police canine bite someone and not report that in a use of force report.
Now, wait a minute. Is that the Middletown?
No.
No, this is a different
case. It's a different department, and it's a story that we'll soon be doing.
Okay.
But most departments view, for example, wrestling someone to the ground as a use of force.
Okay.
Simply handcuffing someone and walking them to the car, even though that person didn't want to be handcuffed. Nobody wants to be handcuffed. That would generally not be considered a use of force. Drawing a weapon, using a weapon of any kind, a bar hold, pressure points, that kind of thing, all uses of force.
Okay. Brian, focused, especially in the first report, mm-hmm. on Newport. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a lot of focus on Newport in both of these first two reports.
Right.
But punching a suspect in the face, yes. multiple times, was striking in the face and the neck unusual as you went through this data?
Yes and no. It happens, certainly, but it doesn't happen frequently. And we found that at Newport, it did happen more frequently than most of the other departments. I think Fairfield had two incidences where they struck a subject, and both times were in the head. So every time they struck somebody, it was in the head, but they only did it twice. Newport was kind of an outlier, and they had 18 different incidences where a subject was struck by a police officer, and
almost half of those incidents were at the hands of one officer.
And about the same amount were aimed at the head.
Okay. And the interesting thing here that I found, or one interesting framing device you used, is not just the incidents themselves, but the reaction to the incidents by the police chiefs. And Craig, would you just sort of contrast the way Newport Chief Tom Collins reacted when you presented him this data and the Boone County Sheriff Michael Helmick has reacted to this sort of data?
I think the Boone County Sheriff's Office has, they had a tough time. They had a tragic shooting back in 2014. A deputy who is still employed there shot and killed a young woman as she drove away from a party. I think it rattled not only a lot of people in the community and obviously the family of the young woman, but it rattled a lot of the deputies and particularly the sheriff. I mean, no one wants that in law enforcement. And so as part of a settlement with her family.
A significant settlement.
$3.5 million. Right. That's a huge settlement, by the way. They came up with a lot of reform, and the reform included body cameras, which they were initially reluctant to use, according to Major Tom Shaven, but they did, and they've used them very effectively. They've also changed the policy, and they've ramped up the training, in particular as it relates to officers learning how to de-escalate emotional and intense situations. One of the things that we found is that in many cases, the officers who seem to be involved with some of the these incidents have a tendency at times to ramp things up themselves. And so they may arrive, one officer in Newport arrived at a scene, and within 30 seconds, he's screaming at people. And 30 seconds later, he's screaming again, and then he arrests somebody. Well, how would that situation have changed if he had come in calmly, tried to figure out what was happening, right, and lowered the tension instead of ramping it up?
Well, in fact, one of the experts that you interviewed talked about that this use of this kind of force should always be avoided if possible, and verbal skills ought to be used. And that's an example of verbal skills going the other way. So, Brian, I want to develop sort of what the theory, what's the best practice that's out there?
Well, I feel like what we've found is that the places that are the departments that are doing this correctly and have low incidence of injury, low incidences of use of force, all are training their officers. One of the things that Boone County did was they started tracking show of force, which is any time an officer pulls out a taser, and even if he doesn't use it. So it allows departments to get a better idea of what their officers are doing, how they're using force, how they're using show of force, and can train them to de-escalate situations rather than escalate.
And that's something you asked about Newport and the difference between Newport and Boone County. And that's something that we didn't find in Newport. There were some very controversial uses of force. And even though the chief told us is now saying that he was uncomfortable with it, that's not acceptable. Well, the chief accepted it. He signed off on it. And in use of force reports provided by Newport, There's never an indication that anything went wrong. The officers were praised in some cases for using empty-handed force, which is basically your fist with nothing in it, and that.
That's what that phrase means.
Empty-handed force.
I thought it meant
is a slap.
Yeah.
Well, it is, but it can also be a punch.
Okay.
And so, you know, if I'm punching somebody in the face 10 times, I'm using empty-handed force. And so, in the case of Marcus Godfrey being hit up to 10 times by Officer Linville, in that report, they actually praised Officer Linville for using empty-handed force and minimizing the injuries to Mr. Godfrey.
One of the things here is that your approach was by beginning with analysis of data, which we all know that that's the way policing is going to take it for all sorts of reasons.
Right.
Not just around force, but where are the problems, where are the – in the case of Boone County – I think part of the reforms was that they had begun to use data systematically. Newport, it struck me, isn't using data. So I was wondering if when you approached the sheriff in Boone County, was he not surprised because he already knew the information? And in the case of the Newport police chief, he's more surprised because he's not in touch with the data, Brian or Craig. I don't know which one wants to talk.
I wasn't at any of the interviews, but that seems consistent with what I've talked to Craig about. Would you agree there?
Yeah, I think that's a good – I think that makes sense to me. I think there's a lot to that.
You know, one of the things about this situation in Boone County, and you've talked about that and the settlement that had to take – that took place because of the killing of Samantha Ramsey. Is it that we only make major changes when faced with the penalty, the pain of a court decision where we got to pay for it? And money sometimes is the way that that gets symbolized. And, you know, it's hard to make big changes without that kind of.
I think, unfortunately, that's true a lot of times. One of the things that's encouraging about our investigation is that we did find some departments that clearly have a commitment to learning from their mistakes. And two of the departments that, you know, I'm thinking of right now would be North College Hill. Officer screwed up and realized it when he watched the tape and decided that the other officers could learn from his mistakes. And so they've incorporated what he did wrong into their training, which is what you always hope. And Covington is another department that seems to take a pretty aggressive approach to learning from the officer's mistakes.
So aggressive to learning, not aggressive to hitting,
correct,
which I think, given the focus. Before we run out of time here, where are you going with this? Yeah, you've got a lot of data. I saw part of your report was you were sitting at a desk piled.
It's crazy.
I can't imagine that you're just going to do two reports and
no,
walk away from
no,
this.
No, absolutely
where
not.
Are you headed?
Well, our next story, which will be next Thursday at 11 p.m., is a story on show of force. And I think it's important for people to realize that even though police officers use force, and in my opinion, rarely it becomes excessive. They also are in situations sometimes where they could use force, but they choose not to.
They choose not to.
And we're gonna focus on some of those.
Well, Craig Cheatham and Brian Nisi of WCPO, thank you. Thank you for your reports.
Thank you.
And thank you for being here today. Football Club Cincinnati is headed to Major League Soccer next year. But before they finish with the United Soccer League, they would like to win the postseason tournament and prove they're ready for the big time. To discuss Saturday's game against the New York Red Bulls, we are joined by FCC reporter from Cincinnati Enquirer, Patrick Brennan, and WVXU reporter, Tana Weingartner. Tana, Brian, Patrick, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, thanks for having me as well.
Well, Patrick, last week's game, which I wasn't at, but I watched the whole thing, pretty exciting game. I mean, you can't write a script any more dramatic than that, I don't think.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if
if everyone necessarily felt that way in the moment just because it was so suspenseful. But, yeah, certainly looking back after the fact, certainly more enjoyable to have gone through the trials and tribulations that the team experienced over 120 minutes of scoreless soccer, and then the ultimate sporting lottery, which is penalty kicks, which ultimately decided the match and saw FC Cincinnati progress. It's that's about as exciting and nerve-wracking as it gets in soccer. And when you're on the right end of it, it's days like that that you never forget.
Tana, I know you're not only a reporter but a fan,
a soccer fan.
So this team has been incredibly good this year, mm-hmm. But there has been sort of this break between regular season success and postseason success,
right?
Which last week's game put the team on a different path, right?
Right. You know, so everybody's sort of saying like the curse, if you will, is broken. Although I don't really know that if a team that's only been around a few years can have a curse, but if you want to call it the Cincinnati curse, which a lot of people seem to do, with the Bengals and Reds not being able to, you know, see much success after the regular season, a lot of people were kind of holding that up as a whatever to say.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, we're doing well finally.
I mean, the team's had an amazing record this year. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, 24-3-8, and of course in soccer you can't have ties, and there's eight. That's where
you
that
can
eight
in the
comes.
Regular season have ties,
right?
But you can't once you go into the playoffs. There has to be a decision to move forward.
You still have to have the, you just keep kicking it beyond those first five first five people. What is it? What would you, Patrick, what would you say is the personality of this team?
Interesting. The playoffs typically, as they progress, not just in USL or MLS, but in any sport, it typically becomes a more nerve-wracking and tense experience for the combatants involved. But FC Cincinnati this week has been very loose. They're having fun. They like to have fun. They really love and enjoy each other's company, and that's been a defining feature of this team, kind of the bond that has been formed since they got together. And a few players were added midstream, but generally this is what you see today is the group that came together in late January to begin training together, and it's part of the reason they're still playing into October, and they hope into November. It's a very tight-knit group. They're very serious. When they have to get down to business, they do, and training sessions are incredibly intense, even at this late stage of the year when, you know, most players have carved out their roles for themselves. But, the defining feature for me has just been how kind of happy-go-lucky and how much these guys all enjoy each other's company, and how much they like to goof off. Honestly, it's a bunch of goofballs. Sometimes you have to. It's hard to reconcile the fact that a team could be so loose and yet still so viciously competitive and successful at the same time. But that's what FC Cincinnati's been in 2018.
Dana, how much does that reflect the coach's personality?
Well, I mean, the coach is obviously a big part of what's going on, especially in the locker room. So he must be doing something right, certainly making his case to stick around as they go into Major League Soccer.
Yeah. Do you find the coach's personality is sort of the team is sort of a reflection of the coach?
Yeah, absolutely. Alan Koch, who I wrote about on Cincinnati.com last night for this morning, really fascinating human being. Something of a globetrotter, has had all kinds of experiences in the game in different parts of the world. And, you know, one thing that always sticks out for me about Alan is his incredible human touch that I think kind of cuts through some of the harsh business realities that come as part of his job. And he gets the best out of the people around him, and he's a serious guy. I think more so than maybe his team. Like I mentioned, they're sometimes a bunch of jokers, So Allen is a little bit more serious, but I think it's that human touch that just puts people at ease around him, because ultimately he is the one that makes the personnel decisions and all manner of decisions. He does that in concert with the technical director, Luke Sassano, and his assistant coaches. But it's as I've said several times now, it's this human touch he has that puts people at ease, even in those pressure situations, and kind of gives players the freedom to express themselves, not just in the game, but as people and as personalities. And I think that's a very heartwarming thing about this team.
Well, Patrick, I want to thank you for being with us today, and I want to make sure that I get in with Tana a report that you did this morning on WVXU about one of the Cincinnati gorillas. Can you just catch us up on that?
Sure. So a Western lowland gorilla named Indume was loaned from the Cincinnati Zoo to the Gorilla Foundation out in California back in 1991 to be a companion for Coco, who was the famous gorilla that allegedly knew how to use sign language and communicate. She was very famous. But Coco died in June, and as part of that agreement with the zoo, Indume is supposed to come back to the Cincinnati Zoo. However, the Gorilla Foundation has said they're not going to return him. So late last night, the Cincinnati Zoo filed a federal lawsuit in court in California requesting the return of Indume. Now, I can say we haven't gotten comment from the Gorilla Foundation in California. However, in the court filings, they do say that they think it's in the best interest of his health for him to stay in California and not be transferred. And they said he did become irate and upset when he heard he might be transferred.
Yes, which I found the most important, and that people should go and listen to your report, because his Coco maybe could use sign language, but he seems to understand human speech.
That is their okay. That's what they say.
Okay, I want to thank Dana Weingartner for being with us. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director, Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website. I'm Dan Hurley.